I am a professor, and that means sometimes I lecture, and this evening I want to talk to you a little bit about the background of the language we use to speak of justification, because it can shed a lot of light on the issue of what we mean and why we use certain terms. I think it's very, very important that we know something about history. I have lamented the fact that for many evangelicals in the United States, church history goes all the way back to Billy Graham. And as a result, we often don't really understand the influences in the past that have determined what some of our controversies are, what language we use to express certain things. And I'm afraid, to be honest with you, that sometimes we, as if we use the term reformed of ourselves, pretty much church history goes back to Martin Luther. Well, you'll never understand Martin Luther if you don't know what came before him in the medieval period. And going all the way back to the early church, it is important to understand something about church history and our place in that grand work of God. And we had a book presented to us last evening by Brother Mike Gadosh that would help you with some of those particular things. The first topic that I taught after graduating from seminary was church history, and it has remained a love of mine. I even got to teach it in Kiev, Ukraine, which was an interesting experience when you do it by translation. But it is important to know these things. And so earlier we had some words read to us from the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith, which are almost identical with some interesting differences from the Westminster Confession of Faith. But I want to read them again, and I want to point your attention to some of the phrases that have a specific apologetic and historical context to them, which will help to, I think, flesh out what some of the emphases of the framers were at that particular point in time. Those whom God effectually calleth, he also freely justifieth, not by infusing righteousness into them. When you have someone say a not, that's probably because they are reacting against what may even be a majority view, or at least a extremely important view in the formation of their own position at that particular point in time. So in this case, in the vast majority of instances, what you have is a reaction to and a refutation of Roman Catholicism and the Roman Catholic view of justification. And so not by infusing righteousness into them, well, that just happens to be what the Roman Catholic concept is when you're baptized as an infant. Grace is infused into you rather than righteousness being imputed to you, which Roman Catholics identify as a legal fiction. A legal fiction. It doesn't really happen. It doesn't actually accomplish anything. And so from the Roman Catholic perspective, grace is infused into you, and in being infused into you, this changes you so that you become pleasing before God. And since God likes to have things that are pleasing to him in his presence, then that's why you go to heaven, is that you're pleasing to God. And so justification involves a subjective change of who you are. Now, if you're thinking with me, you're going, well, that's actually sanctification. Yes, if you read the works of the reformers, if you read the second generation, third generation, especially once the Counter-Reformation begins with the Jesuits and things like that, you will see that they specifically refer to the fact that Rome conflates justification and sanctification. The Bible connects the two together. They are absolutely necessary to be seen together, but they must be distinguished from one another. If you confuse them, if you conflate them, then the very ground of our peace with God is lost. And that's what happens in Roman Catholicism. So not by infusing righteousness into them, but by pardoning their sins and by accounting and accepting their persons as righteous. Notice it doesn't say changing them into something that is righteous. It says by pardoning their sins and by accounting. And what do you think, what term do you think that's referring to? That's in the Greek language, legizomai, to impute, to reckon. By counting and accepting their persons as righteous, not for anything wrought in them, there's the echo of the Roman Catholic concept again, or done by them, which would be their fulfillment of the sacramental aspects of Roman Catholic teaching, but for Christ's sake alone, not by imputing faith itself, the act of believing, or any other evangelical obedience to them as their righteousness, but by imputing Christ's active obedience under the whole law and passive obedience in his death for their whole and soul righteousness. Now, here is where the London Baptist Confession differs from the Westminster Confession of Faith. And it is influenced here. There's some great material on this, especially I just got back a few months ago from a trip down to Australia and New Zealand. I had never been to New Zealand before. I had the opportunity of speaking at a conference down there. And once again, I ran into my fellow bow tie wearing aficionado, Dr. Jim Renahan. And we're going to win. I'm sorry, brother. You're doomed. Are you looking around here? Are you noticing how many more there are showing up? So just give it up. Wow, the look I'm getting right now could melt wood. And this is, wow. Jim Renahan, who I allowed, during one of the sessions, I allowed him to go ahead and wear his bow tie, and I didn't wear one. Because though he wears a bow tie, they are just the most dreadfully boring things that will ever be seen. And so I didn't want to just completely blow his away by my much more colorful, fashionable ones. And so if you want to know everything there is to know about the London Baptist Confession of Faith and the differences and stuff like that, Jim Renahan is your man. I just know a few facts. But one of the facts that I know is that under the influence of people like John Owen, this formulation that you see here has protected us, I mentioned this briefly this morning, has protected us from, confessionally anyways, from the influence of the new perspective on Paul, federal visionism, and a basic deterioration in the view of justification by faith. But because this terminology is not in the Westminster Confession of Faith, it has not been able to confessionally function for them the same way it has for us. I'm referring specifically to the delineation of Christ's active and passive obedience. Now, this is something that I think if you come to a conference on justification, it might be good for you to have a very clear understanding of what the difference between active and passive obedience is. You will notice it's sort of defined for you. When it says passive obedience in his death, then you have what most people think about when they think about the righteousness of Christ and justification. What most people think about is the reality that in the atoning sacrifice of Christ, you have the origin of the righteousness that is given to us because it's in the forgiveness of sins. And so when Christ atones for sin, then we receive that righteousness as a result of his work. And so for most people, that's enough. But think with me for just a moment. What did Jesus say the greatest commandment was? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Now, am I looking at anyone here today that has done that? I mean, today might be a good day to do it. You're amongst Christians. Or hopefully there's not too many distractions and too many temptations, even though there might be some folks in here that sort of bother you, so maybe you've fallen short along that ways. I mean, it could happen, I suppose, but loving God perfectly. How many of us have done that throughout our entire lives? Well, none of us have, obviously. And yet it's the greatest commandment. And so what about all the commandments to do, to fulfill duties? What about those? How do we have a perfect righteousness before God if all we're talking about in righteousness is the removal of the positive acts of sin, but not the fulfillment of the positive commands? And so when we think about it, you know, people have sometimes asked the question, well, why did Jesus live for 30 years in relative obscurity? What was he doing all that time? He was loving God perfectly. He was keeping all the commandments. He was doing everything that we don't do. And so the life that he gives, which he gives voluntarily, that sacrifice that he gives provides to us a perfect and full righteousness that does not allow for any addition on our part. This definition of justification really closes the door on any kinds of work salvation system that's out there, if you really understand what it's saying. And it really closes the door on what the reformers were responding to. Now, obviously, you know, when we think about what happened with Martin Luther, when we think about what happened in the process whereby he came to understand what justification was, you know, he didn't have it all clear at first. And in fact, you can argue even by the end of his life, he didn't have it all worked out. How many of us would be able to work through 1,100 years of tradition and come to a completely and fully biblical understanding of something? If any of you think you're that able to just stand back and have that kind of a perspective, I just don't know that you've done a whole lot of reading in church history, or maybe don't know a whole lot about your own heart, because each one of us has been influenced deeply by so many different streams of tradition. And if we don't know what those streams of tradition are, we can never examine them in the light of Scripture. And it's a process, and it takes time. And when you're running for your life and have all of the types of distractions that people like Luther had or Zwingli had, it's sort of understandable to see why there are certain places where, from our vantage point, we can go, well, you know, they could have pressed on toward a full reformed position, but they didn't. We have to be very careful when we look at history to let people be who they were in the context in which they lived. But when we think about the system that they were responding to, we need to understand it. Now, we look at modern-day Roman Catholicism, and yes, there are still Roman Catholics today that are very conservative in their theology, despite Pope Franky, who obviously is not conservative in his theology at all. The other pope, who is a pope but really isn't a pope, but we're really not sure what he is, but he's still around. Benedict XVI, better known as Cardinal Ratzinger, who was the head of what the modern embodiment of the Inquisition was. Okay, he was called the German Shepherd. There was a reason for that. He was German, he was the Pope, but he was also a German Shepherd. And so he was a much more conservative guy. We sort of knew where he was coming from. But when you look at the theology of Roman Catholicism that the reformers were reacting against, and by the time you get to the middle of the 17th century, there's been time for thinking these things through and making clear distinctions. What you have is an emphasis in our documents upon the perfection of justification that truly sheds light on what the controversy of the day was. Now, how many of you, by the way, are former Roman Catholics? Not as many as I expected. That's very interesting. I speak in many contexts where half the hands in the room come up, but that was barely 5%. That's very, very interesting to me. It's maybe the least former Roman Catholic audience I've addressed, except in the mosque. That was, for some reason, probably a little bit more than that. But anyway, then I do need to explain this then, because it does help you to understand. How many of you have ever heard of Luther's example of the pile of dung? Okay, let's try this another way. How many of you have not heard of Luther's example of the pile of dung? How many of you just sat there and did not put your hand up because you do not want to participate? Never understood that part. I'm not putting my hand up. No. Mm-mm. Not calling on me. What do you think I'm going to do? Ask you a question from up here or something? Have I done that? No. It's funny. Anyway, okay, well, here's the story. Now, first of all, we don't know whether Luther ever told the story. And by the way, Just because it appears in a meme on Facebook does not make it true, okay? Just in case anyone was wondering, it does not make it true. It was shocking to me, for example, for Martin Luther King Day a little while ago, I saw stuff attributed to Martin Luther King that Martin Luther said. And it's like, really? You're 500 years out of sync here. I mean, honestly, it's pretty amazing. But there's all sorts of statements found in literature attributed to Martin Luther that when you actually go to his works and you search for him and stuff, it's like, where did this come from? So you have to be a little bit careful. And no one has ever actually found this example in Luther. So it's attributed to him. It sure does sound like him because Luther was a really earthy, German-like, lived-on-a-farm type guy. And if you've read his table talks, you know that he could be, I'm just going to stick with earthy for right now. Let's just say that a lot of the things he said would make teenage boys giggle a lot, especially talking about bodily functions and things like that. So he's talking about, allegedly, a pile of dung. And there would be, in those days, you couldn't go down to the store and buy fertilizer for your field. You had to use your farm animals to produce fertilizer. And so you would clean up the yard, you'd clean up the pasture, and you'd shovel all that stuff into one spot. And by the end of the season, you'd have quite a pile of excrement there that you would then use the next spring to spread on your fields as the fertilizer for your fields. That was just how things were done. And obviously, by the heyday of summer, at the end of the summer, that was not a nice thing to look at. It smelled, and there were lots of flies, and you wanted to stay upwind of it, and it was just reprehensible. You didn't want to be around it. But it was a necessary thing. So here was his illustration, allegedly. His illustration was that the righteousness of Christ, justification, is like the first snowfall of the winter. And it comes and it covers everything with that beautiful, perfect blanket of white. You know, before the first cars come through, before the first persons tracked it up, it's that perfect, beautiful blanket of white. And it even covers the pile of dung. And it takes away the flies and it takes away the smell. And it's no longer offensive and everything's beautiful. And he says, justification is that alien righteousness. It comes from God. It's not us. And it covers that pile of dung. But it's still a pile of dung. But it's now no longer offensive to God because of an alien righteousness that covers it. Now, he would have said, and it is then God's purpose to begin changing that pile of dung into something other than a pile of dung. And that's sanctification. But that never becomes the grounds of our relationship to God. It is always that perfect covering righteousness of Jesus Christ that is the grounds of our relationship to God. Now, the Counter-Reformation began with the Council of Trent and the founding of the Jesuits. And they were very successful in many lands where the Reformation had gone and making great, great strides. They came in and there were many nations that were turned back to Roman Catholicism by the Counter-Reformation. It was quite the apologetic war. There was lots of wars going on religiously and there was lots of theological wars going on as well. And obviously, a concept such as that would draw the fire of Roman Catholic apologists, and it does to this day. In fact, it's interesting, in the debate I did last Wednesday evening in Atlanta with Trent Horn, staff apologist for Catholic Answers, he specifically used the terminology at one point in his comments of the Protestant idea of justification as a legal fiction. A legal fiction. And see, what they're saying is, it's still a pile of dung. So talking about it as righteousness is a fiction. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just simply an accounting tool. It's something that allows God to get you to heaven without actually changing you. And so they really go after Luther's example. And I don't know a lot of people that have come up with a defense of it. Maybe because you just want to defend a pile of dung. Maybe that's just not what people want to do. But I came up with one. Because I sort of like to put the shoe on the other foot. And so the Roman Catholic view, let's ask about a pile of dung in the Roman Catholic perspective. What happens in justification? Well, from the Roman Catholic perspective, there is an infusion of grace into the soul of the individual. So to use this illustration, what happens is at baptism, the pile of dung becomes a pile of gold, instantly changed into something that is pleasing to God. And so God takes it to heaven because God likes gold. I mean, he paves the streets with it, so he must need a lot of it. And so he takes it to heaven because it's pleasing to him. It's intrinsically pleasing to God, and that's why you go to heaven. Well, that sounds pretty nice. I'd like to be a pile of gold. That's good. But there's a little bit of a problem. In Roman Catholic theology, there are two kinds of sin. You have mortal sins, and you have venial sins. When you're baptized, you enter into what's called the state of grace. The state of grace. You're a friend of God. You're that pile of gold. And when you die, you're going to go to heaven. But what about all the sacraments? What about penances and things like that? Well, they recognize you're going to sin. And so if you commit a venial sin, venial sins do not destroy the state of grace. You still remain a pile of gold even when you commit venial sin. Now, what are the venial sins? What are the mortal sins? Depends on which priest you talk to. And it's changed a lot over the years. And it's always been somewhat of a theological scandal that you go into one church and a priest and confess one sin. The priest will call it a mortal sin and walk down the street a little ways, go into another church, and that priest will identify it as a venial sin, because outside of a few major, major sins like murder, there really isn't an infallible list of which one is which is somewhat troubling given that one destroys the grace of justification, one doesn't. But a venial sin does not destroy the state of grace, but it does bring temporal punishments in this life, punishments in time. And so you have to go through confession and penance, and so you'll be assigned certain acts of contrition and penance to do. So it might be 10 Our Fathers and 5 Hail Marys, or giving a certain amount to the poor, or things along these lines. But these are things that you then do that merit grace from God, that counteracts and removes the temporal punishments of sin. But the problem is, how you do those things will also impact how effective they are. So let's say you don't really like the priest and you think that he gave you way too many Our Fathers to say. And so if you don't really say them with the proper attitude, with the proper disposition, they're not going to have the same effect they would have than if you really had the proper disposition, the proper idea and attitude when you were doing it. And so you might do your penances, but what happens is little pieces of dung start to appear on the surface of the gold. And unless you're a saint, now see, if you're a saint, now there's two kinds of saints. There are the saints that the church does not declare, and that's technically if you have more merit by your good deeds and so on and so forth, then you have temporal punishments on your soul, then you're a saint when you die, and you go directly into the presence of God. Then you have the canonized saints, which is what you hear about. They just did that with John Paul II. And that's where the church specifically makes a statement about an individual that they are a saint that can be prayed to by the church and their intercession sought. And there's a whole process you have to go through. You have to become blessed, and then you become a saint. And there has to be 2 miracles that they can document that were associated with somebody praying to you or being involved in your life, or you performed or something in your life, blah, 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 blah. So John Paul II has been made a saint. He was on the fast track. There's been, you know, there's I don't know how many saints there are, but there's lots of them out there. So there's 2 different kinds of saints. Vast majority of Roman Catholics that die are not saints in either one of those 2. They have more temporal punishments of sin upon their soul then they have merit. And so they are a pile of gold, as long as they haven't committed a mortal sin, they're a pile of gold, but they've got dung all over them. So what's going to happen to that? Well, it has to be purified. God's not going to have a dungy pile of gold in his presence, and that's why you have purgatory. You have to go to purgatory, and in purgatory, you undergo what's called satispatio, the suffering of atonement, that removes those impurities, purifies you into a pure pile of gold, and then you can eventually enter into the presence of God. Now, in the years before Martin Luther, there was a tremendous amount of discussion of how long purgatory lasted. And there were saints who had visions of popes in purgatory that had died centuries earlier. Now, if the Pope's still in purgatory after 200 years, how long are you going to be there? And what's worse, how long are your loved ones going to be there? Your mother, your father. Remember, in these days, a woman would normally have to have 10 live births to get one child through to adulthood. So you had children who had died. You had family members who had died. And here you're being taught that they are undergoing this horrific, painful suffering in flames and purgatory for literally hundreds of years. And only those who are in the state of grace get to go to purgatory. It's not a second chance place. Non-Christians don't go to purgatory. You have to be a friend of God. You have to be a pile of gold, covered in dung, but a pile of gold, to go to purgatory. And so what happened during the medieval period, what started this whole Reformation thing, was they had developed the idea that Jesus only had to shed one drop of blood to redeem the whole world. But since he shed his blood copiously, this created this whole extra pile of merit that Jesus accomplishes in his death. And Mary, oh man, Mary never sinned. And she was even protected preemptively from committing original sin, too, by the merits of Christ, of course, according to the Roman Catholic Church, eventually. That was something that developed over time. But so she had all sorts of extra merit. And every saint has at least a little extra merit. I suppose there are some that are perfectly even, but most saints have some extra merit. And what do you do with all this extra merit? Well, the idea developed, and again, this is not something the early church believed, but these are almost everything in history is the result of strands of development that you would, when they first started, you would never think they were going to get together, but 150 years later, they get together and someone comes up with this wild idea. And so the idea eventually developed that this creates what's called the Thesaurus Meritorum, the treasury of merit. And guess who controls the treasury of merit? Ah, yes. He who has the keys of Peter, the Pope in Rome. And so the church has access to this huge treasury of merit, and they can make withdrawals from the treasury of merit and can do transfers to your account. And this is called an indulgence. An indulgence. And there are more sections in the modern universal catechism of the Catholic Church on indulgences than there are on justification. It wasn't just back then. What has changed? You can't just buy them for a set fee anymore. You have to do things. For example, just last year, Pope Francis, Year of Mercy. There were certain doors in certain cathedrals that were opened around the world. And if you would travel in pilgrimage to those doors at those cathedrals and just simply walk through this door in faith, you would get a plenary indulgence, a complete forgiveness of all of your sins, just by walking through a door. That was just last year. This is still Roman Catholic teaching. And so the gross selling of these things to make money Albrecht, Archbishop of Mainz, had borrowed 30,000 ducats to buy his position, and so he let a Dominican in to preach the indulgence trade, and that's the one that Luther ran into, and that's where it all came from. And everybody knew it was a corrupt mess in Rome, and that positions were bought and sold and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But there was a theological basis for it, and this is what indulgences were all about. And the story is told that Tetzel, the Dominican friar, would come in and have the chest, you put the money in, and he'd have these little boys sing, "When a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs." And we might look back and go, oh man, what superstition. But think about it if you lived in that day. You're surrounded by death. We don't hardly ever see death. But back then, you walk down the road, you'd see a dead body along the side of the road. People, the plague was still around. You saw death all the time. There were all these strange diseases that would take people out. You didn't even see it coming. They're fine one day, dead the next. And if it was your father, your mother, your sister, your brother that you thought was bathed in flames and purgatory, and you could do something to help them, you can see why the purgatory the indulgence trade did pretty well. It did pretty well. And in fact, I've been in the Vatican in Rome, and if you look up, it's just the most gaudy place. I've never seen so much marble in my life. But the crypts of the various medieval popes and Reformation popes, just amazing. But in the cupola, in the big dome that you see at the Vatican, you look up there, and around the inside, in Latin, it has the Petrine promise from Matthew chapter 16, and it's in gold, not gold paint, gold. And where did it come from? Indulgence trade. That's how St. Peter's was built. And that was one of the things the Germans rebelled against. They knew their money for indulgences was leaving Germany and going down to Rome to build real pretty buildings for the Pope. And that created a lot of hard feelings that were a part of why the Reformation took place. So temporal punishments of sin, you get all the stuff on your soul. And so the pile of gold gets dung all over it. It has to be cleaned up before it can go into the presence of God, in the Roman Catholic perspective. What about mortal sins? Well, it's real easy. If you're a pile of gold and you commit a mortal sin, you're back to being a pile of dung again. And so you have to go through the sacrament of penance and contrition and confession, and you, in Roman Catholicism, can be turned back into a pile of gold with dung on you. Because the only time you just immediately go to a real nice pile of gold is baptism. But if you are a pile of gold and then you become a pile of dung, you lose the grace of justification. Then when you become a pile of gold again, but now you've got a bunch of temporal punishments even for that. And so there's penances to do and the whole nine yards. And so you never get to go all the way back to that pristine state. But here's the problem. Ludwig Ott, in his book Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma, said, "The reason for the uncertainty of the state of grace lies in just this, that no one without a special revelation from God can know with certainty whether they have fulfilled all the conditions which are necessary for achieving justification." Did you hear that? Fulfilled all the conditions which are necessary for achieving justification. They can never know. You know what that means? That means the Roman Catholic can never know whether they are a pile of dung or a pile of gold. Because to assume you're a pile of gold is a sin of presumption. You can have some level of confidence, but you can never know. You can never know. That's the Roman Catholic version. I'd never heard anyone put the shoe on the other foot and challenge them to think through, well, what's your system saying? And there's a huge contrast between that too. Because even, let's flesh out the Roman Catholic one just a little bit farther. Aside from the horrific fact, I remember my mom. This is back when we still lived in Pennsylvania, so it was even before we moved to Arizona. My mom went to a Roman Catholic funeral, and she came back going, "Oh, it was just so hopeless. They're all talking about how they hoped this person hadn't committed a sin right before they died, and there was just wailing, and there wasn't any peace, and it was just so different than what you experience with the gospel. And I remember her saying that and thinking about what that must be like to not know if you're a pile of dung or a pile of gold, whether you've fulfilled all the conditions which are necessary. I hope what's going through everyone's mind here this evening is not that, well, have I fulfilled all the conditions which are necessary? If that's you, we need to talk to you about the gospel. Because you see, to be a Christian, you have someone who fulfilled all those things for you. That's our Savior. That's what he did. That's not something we do. But you see, Rome doesn't even have a finished sacrifice of Christ. Oh, yes, they talk about Christ died once upon the cross, blah, 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 blah. But if you understand anything about the Mass, you know that the Mass is a representation of the one sacrifice of Christ that perfects no one. It perfects no one. My opponent last week got up during his rebuttal period and said, I didn't hear anything in the passages that James cited that says that the atonement of Christ actually perfects anyone. Because in Roman Catholicism, the atonement of Christ doesn't perfect anyone. You can go to 20,000 masses in your life and still die impure. You can go to 20,000 masses in your life, commit a mortal sin, and go to hell. 20,000 times to Calvary, still lost. Think about that. And you know what I couldn't help but think about? And I don't want to get anybody in major league trouble here. But I will anyways. I even wrote in my notes at the end of the debate, he was ransacking the Bible looking for texts where Jesus died for somebody and they were lost, because that's what he needs. You know who else does that? The traditionalist Southern Baptists do that. I've debated Leighton Flowers, and I listen to what they're saying, and they ransack. They go to John chapter 10. And I have other sheep. And instead of seeing that as the Jews and the Gentiles, which is what has been the interpretation down through the history of church, they have to find some way to not allow that to stand and to not allow Jesus' death to be perfect in behalf of people, because you've got to have people for whom Jesus died who are going to go to hell so we can prove universal atonement. They've done it with Judas. They do it in John chapter 10. And here I am listening to Roman Catholic doing it, and I'm going, I hope the synergists are listening this evening. And when it gets posted, I hope you'll listen to it and find out and realize almost every, I'll take that back, every single argument he presented against quote-unquote eternal security was perfectly consistent with that of a synergist arguing against the sovereignty of God and salvation. I was amazed. I even wrote it in my notes. Wow, this is an amazing thing. This is an amazing thing to see. They don't have a finished work. They don't have a finished work. And so when you understand that Rome doesn't have a finished work, then you can begin to understand how vitally important this issue of justification was to the Reformation, and why the proclamation of sola fide, justification by faith alone, was the material principle of the Reformation. Remember, the Reformation had a material principle and a formal principle. Material and formal principles. The material principle, what was being the substance of the preaching, justification by faith. What was the formal principle? Well, at the time when Luther first came to understand justification by faith, he didn't quite understand this aspect yet. It was a debate, interestingly enough, which I find rather good. It was a debate that forced him to begin the process of coming to recognize what's called the formal principle, sola scriptura, because he lost the debate. But in losing the debate, he realized why he lost the debate, and that was he didn't have a firm foundation, and you have to find out what your ultimate authorities are. And the ultimate authority is that which God has spoken in his word, and not the Pope, not the councils, not the traditions of the church, etc., etc., etc. And so there you have the two elements of the Reformation in the material and formal principles. So in Roman Catholicism, then, to this day, No assurance, no finished work. The results, very clearly, if you've been to a Roman Catholic wake, it's not a joyous place. It's not a joyous place. It can't be. It can't be. But here's the other thing, and I'll rush to finish up here. When you stand before God in the Roman Catholic system, let's say you've finally gotten there. You're the pile of gold. But of what does your righteousness consist? Let's say you received indulgences. Let's say after your death, your family worked out indulgences for you, or you used indulgences during your life. Let's say you did one of those pilgrimages, and you walked through one of the doors of mercy and so on and so forth, even the Pope was talking about just last year. So now you stand before God. We say that we will stand before God clothed in the seamless robe of the righteousness of Christ. In other words, it's not a patchwork. There is only one type of righteousness. It's Christ's righteousness. It's his active and passive obedience. But while we distinguish them, that doesn't mean that they're different kinds, as if half of it is active and half of it is passive or something. It's the point that the life that the God-man gives is a full and perfect righteousness. That life gives us a full and perfect righteousness. Doesn't just take away sin, but it also includes his active obedience to the law of God. That's a perfect righteousness. That's why in Romans chapter 8, who is he who condemns? This is the thing I brought up with Trent Horn, and he never answered it, never even tried to go there. Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? If any of God's elect can ever be lost, someone has to be able to bring a successful charge against them, right? Who can do it? God is the one who justifies. Christ Jesus is who died, yea, rather was raised again, and is at the right hand of the Father interceding for us. So who can bring a charge? There isn't anybody who can bring a charge. That's the only ground of ever believing in something like eternal security, the preservation and perseverance of the saints, is the perfection of the work of the Savior in their behalf. But you see, the Roman Catholic, when he or she stands before God, they have the righteousness of Christ, Mary, who knows how many different saints, and if they went through purgatory, the suffering you experience in purgatory is called satis passio. And you actually atone for the punishments of your own sins in purgatory. So you have your own. It's a patchwork quilt. You cannot say it is solely the righteousness of Christ. Now, here's what the Roman Catholic apologist will say. Yeah, but the work of Christ makes it all possible. That's not the same thing. That's not the same thing. So think about what that means. Will that avail before God a patchwork righteousness? Not from the New Testament perspective. Not from the New Testament perspective at all. So you see, we spend time looking at Romans, and we work through Romans 3 and 4 and 5, and we come to the conclusions there, and we'll do that tomorrow morning. And we look at Galatians, and we see the clash in Galatians, and we see Paul saying such strong words. He says in chapter 5, if you're seeking to be justified by the law, you've been severed from Christ. He's of no use to you. Stop talking about Jesus. Wow. Can you imagine what it was like when Galatians was read in the churches in Galatia? Can you imagine what that was like? Can you imagine the people sitting there knowing that on the next row over were the Judaizing teachers? And they liked them. And here this guy is up there reading this letter from Paul, and he's ripping their lips off. The social afterwards stunk. I mean, that Baptist potluck that day was, nobody was talking. People were crying in their mashed potatoes. It was horrible. But you know why Paul did it? He said so in Galatians, so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. With tears he wrote that letter, knowing what it was going to cause. All because this is central and definitional to the gospel. And finally, let me close with this. My ministry would be much bigger if I didn't deal with Islam, of course, duh. But especially if I didn't deal with Roman Catholicism, because a lot of folks are like, well, my Aunt May was just the finest woman, and she was Roman Catholic. I'm just not sure I can support you evangelizing those people. Why do I evangelize Roman Catholics? It's not popular today. Closes a lot of doors in my face. I evangelize Roman Catholics today because the book of Galatians is still in the canon of the New Testament. Amen. And when I look at what it says, if Paul is willing to anathematize someone for adding one thing to the gospel, you just have to become a Jew first. It's just circumcision. Enter into the old covenant before you get into the new covenant. I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? One thing. And then I look at what Rome has added. Doctrine after doctrine after doctrine. They make the Judaizers look like amateurs. If Paul anathematized the one, how can anyone say that Rome's gospel is the gospel that saves? No one's ever been able to explain that to me. Oh, I know, N.T. Wright has a way around all of it. Well, you're all wrong. The Reformation was wrong. The Catholics were wrong. The church has been wrong. I figured it out, finally, after 2,000 years. Okay, well, all right. Well, I'm sorry, but that's the conclusion he comes to if you've read his stuff. He's basically saying Rome had asked the wrong question. The Reformation provided the right answer to the wrong questions. Justification has nothing to do with soteriology. It has to do with church fellowship. That's it. You've missed it. And so he really does believe if we just all go his direction, we'd all get to be one. So those things aside, as long as Rome continues to teach a gospel that falls under the condemnation of the anathema of Galatians chapter 1, then they need to hear the gospel of peace. And that's not the gospel that Rome teaches, and so that's why I have to continue to do that. So I hope looking at some of the historical issues sheds some light on why we use the terminology we do, why these issues are vitally important, and hopefully maybe just sort of in passing, I've encouraged you to be one who is going to be a little bit quicker maybe to present the gospel to that Roman Catholic co-worker. Now, obviously, there are many Roman Catholics that know very little about their theology, so don't sit there and try to give them a lesson on mortal and venial sins if they don't really need that. You don't need to, you know, they're lost enough. You don't need to get them more lost before you try to get them saved. But there are many Roman Catholics out there. They listen to Roman Catholic radio. They listen to the Catholic answers and things like that. And you need to have some background to be able to provide the proper presentation to them, and hopefully one that the Lord will use to his honor and glory in drawing his people to himself. Thank you very much.